listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 25. Welcome. So today we are talking all about ADHD, and we have a mother and teacher on the show who has a huge amount of direct personal experience of ADHD. Her name is Solly Lazarus. She works part-time in a school in London supporting children with ADHD and other learning difficulties, but she also runs her own consultancy where she supports families who are struggling to manage a child with ADHD and have a happy life at the same time. And she's also written a book on the subject, and this is a really, really great conversation. So I really hope you enjoy it. Just before we head over to the interview, I just wanted to remind you though that I have a revision workshop coming up on the 16th of December for students who are taking their mocks in January, so straight after Christmas. And I've run two of these revision workshops already this term, one before October half term and one in November, and they've gone down really, really well with students who were overwhelmed and procrastinating because they weren't really sure about how to approach their revision, have really made big breakthroughs about, you know, how to plan their revision, how to prioritize, and how they should actually be revising. So the workshop is really practical. Students will do practical tasks in the 2 hours to really get themselves in a really strong position so that when they finish the workshop, they can go away, have a bite to eat, and then come back and actually get on with their revision and make some serious progress. So if your child is taking January mocks, I'd really love you to sign them up for that. The workshop's taking place on the morning of the 16th of December, which is a Saturday, between 10 and 12. If your child can't attend live, I will record the workshop and so I can send it out to you afterwards. When you sign up for the workshop, you'll also get a free copy of my Kindle book, which is called Revision Quick Start Guide. And it's a really quick and easy read that is designed to do exactly what it says on the tin. It's designed to get your child revising quickly. So it's only £15. So if you'd like your child to come along and do that, go and visit the show notes at lifemoreextraordinary.com/25 and you'll find the link there to sign up. Okay, let's get over to the interview with Solly now. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Solly Lazarus.
Hello, thank you very much, Lucy, for inviting me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Okay, what I want to ask you first, Solly, is what is ADHD and what's the difference between ADHD and ADD? Because I think a lot of people get confused about that. So can you give us what it is, first of all?
So in a nutshell, it's the difference is the H. Mm-hmm. So ADHD, it's hyperactivity element, and ADD is children and adults who have the condition but don't have their hyperactivity element, so they're not sort of as bouncy as the children with ADHD.
Okay, so what is the ADD bit then? Explain what that is and how it shows itself in a child.
Yeah, sure. So the three general characteristics are that children are inattentive, mm-hmm. impulsive, and very hyperactive. So, but it has to be, because most children at some point in their little lives are going to show those three criteria, so inattentive, not being able to focus, to being fidgety, to butting in conversations. But we really start to worry as professionals and as parents when that is causing problems and difficulties wherever they're going. So at granny's house and at clubs and after school clubs and brownies and school, and the park. So whatever situation our children are in, if they're exhibiting that kind of behaviour and they've been at school for a little while, so they know, yes, you know, at certain times we have to sit still, but they're still exhibiting that kind of behaviour, I think that's when we have to sort of, you know, our lights start flashing wildly. Okay. And we realise that there is some kind of problem.
So it's basically they literally can't in any circumstances have that self-control to be able to exactly. sit still or concentrate or yeah. you know, wait their turn to speak and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. As it happens today, there is an awful lot in the media about ADHD, and it's for so many years it's been considered just bad parenting, mm-hmm. Where now we really understand that it is an actual neurological condition. There are chemicals that aren't firing properly, and yes, you're right, children just cannot sit still. It's like they haven't got the brakes. It's like they have two magnets repelling against one another. They find it very, very difficult. And a lot of their strength and energy is going into keeping still. And then they're missing the content of the lesson, or they're missing mum saying, could you please go and get me your toothbrush? Because they're so focused on putting all their energy into trying to manage that they miss an awful lot of other things that are going on. And yes, you're right. They really can't help it. It's not something, you know, with just like a reward put in place that magically the ADHD will go away. It needs constant support and help and sort of changes in the environment to help them manage.
Okay. So what you said there was that for years and years, people have thought it was bad parenting that caused yeah. it. Can that be an element that exacerbates it? So I'll give you an example for yeah. the reason why I asked this question. When I was teaching in a secondary school, I had a little lad, he was in year 7, and he'd been yeah. diagnosed with ADHD. And he was, you know, everything that you have described. But the poor little lad, his parents had split up, and he spent alternate nights of every single week
yes.
between the different parents' homes. So yes. every night he was sleeping in a different bed in a different house from the night yeah. he was in before. And I didn't have a strong understanding of the condition, but I can only think as a parent and knowing how much children need routine and structure and all that kind of
yes.
thing, that would exacerbate the condition. So yeah. what would you say about that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we have to consider what are the causes, and the causes, as I say, it could be genetic, it's neurological, it could be birth trauma, and then once those genes have formulated in the way that they are going to form, and the child now exhibits ADHD, then it's really important that we all create a wonderful environment to enable our children to cope. And if that environment is chaotic, or parents haven't got the skills or the mindset or the language to help, then yes, the situation is going to be worse and worse and worse. Yeah. The other thing with our children is that because they can see that, you know, they're quite often labelled as naughty, other children don't gravitate towards them. So they find making friendships very, very difficult. I mean, my son, who has ADHD, he's now 29, but when he was at school, there's not one birthday invitation, no play dates, a whole summer holiday with not one person coming round. So my son's self-esteem was literally on the floor. That's, you know, so and even now as an adult, he has anxieties, he has lots of social issues. So yes, going back to your question, it is, you know, but good parenting, I would say, good parenting can help. And if a parent is equipped with knowing how to handle anger problems and how to make everything in very quick, short, sharp steps and give children very quick instructions, you know, if you know all those little techniques, we can help our children. But, you know, if we're exhausted parents, yeah. we end up shouting and demanding and being angry, then the only response our child will have is to be angry and shouting and swearing in response to that. So yeah, parenting really plays a big part.
That's really sad. Yeah. Okay, let's go back to the beginning then and try and think about what signs parents will see in the beginning that might indicate that their child has ADHD. So for instance, I've got a 5-year-old, and when he thinks of something to say, he always can't wait to say it, and he's quite stuttery sometimes because I think he finds it difficult to find the words, and so he hasn't got the patience, or he hasn't really got the opportunity to wait to say what he wants to say. I mean, I don't think probably he has got ADHD, but when should that kind of behaviour start to ring the alarm bells?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. We have to balance it with what is normal, usual toddler, young children behaviour, and then what is causing more of a problem. And I think little boy. If wherever he went, he was exhibiting that kind of behaviour and it's causing problems, and alongside constantly on the move, fidgeting, very disorganized.
No, he's not like that at all. No.
Yeah, not have an understanding of other people's personal space, asking inappropriate questions. You know, if he's exhibiting that kind of behaviour wherever he goes, and I think you as a mum, you know, you look around and you see what other children are doing, and I think mums instinctively know in your gut that there's something not quite right. And I think this is where, because I run a support group for families, and I coach on a one-to-one as well, and I hear the same thing time and time again at the battle with school, because parents know when there is something not quite right. And we can keep going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And if the right strategies are not put in place, then, you know, a child can then start getting aggressive and angry. So, again, I've wandered off what you've asked me. But so when to really worry is, I think, when all the different places that your child is going is reporting back to you.
Yeah.
We've got a problem here.
And you know, the age that you would typically start to see that? Is it in toddlerhood? Is it when they start school?
Well, I think it's really when they start school, because that's the first time that they're going to have to follow rules, follow instructions, sit still, walk in a line, only talk when they are allowed to talk, you know. Criticizing schools is one of my favorite topics, although I'm a teacher. Our system is so wrong, it's so antiquated. We could shake our system up a million times and it probably still wouldn't be right. You know, our children who find it very, very difficult to follow rules and sit still and follow 3 instructions at one time, are suddenly faced with this very strange system, whereas before they were allowed to run around and nursery and choose what they can do in their own, you know, for their own interests, and then suddenly, bam, you know, they have to sit still. So really, I'd say, you know, four, five, you would know. Parents would know before then anyway.
Yeah, and when would you typically see a diagnosis? And presumably it doesn't happen straight away once parents have kind of picked up that maybe there's something not quite right.
Yes. Well, then this now comes down to budget for schools, which is another reason why I hate the whole system, because then it will just be a question of getting the educational psychologist in to have a look. School, depending whether you're lucky enough to be in a borough that gives schools a lot of budget in order to have an educational psychologist come in. They are allocated a certain amount of time per school, but if a particular school has got more children that need to be assessed, then obviously there's going to be a waiting list.
So does it always happen that way through like the local education authority, or does it, and presumably that's changing a bit with academies and all that kind of thing, or can parents seek support, for example, through the NHS or privately? What are the options there?
Yes, so either the school can start flagging things up, and then the school has to have the parents' permission for the educational psychologist to see them. Mm-hmm. Or you could go to your GP and discuss it with your GP and to be seen by a community paediatrician. Mm-hmm. Or you could go the private route and see a professional that way.
So which do you think is the most successful, kind of productive route to follow?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question, and I'm not 100% sure of the answer because, I have conflicting ideas about it, because I think if you go a bit too early to down the private route, you might not get a thorough diagnosis that you actually want. You might get a diagnosis that is popular or fashionable at the time. I mean, that doesn't sound
so rather than
graceful,
an accurate diagnosis,
rather than, you know, I'd rather it become, you know, school when it, and the other thing with a private consultant is they're seeing the child for, I don't know, half an hour. Mm-hmm. Yes, they're listening to the parents and hearing about all the things that are going on, but a school has a child there for 6 hours every day for years. Mm-hmm. And you can build up a real bank of evidence and a real bank of different behaviours. And I think you can have a much more clearer, thorough picture if, you know, with the professionals at school.
Yeah.
Saying that, you can wait forever and a day for a school diagnosis because of this trouble with funding. So if you can back up a school diagnosis with a private consultant, I mean, I sound like I'm going backwards and forwards here, but this is exactly how crazy the system is, because we've all read about CAMHS, the Children and Adolescent Mental Health Service, is in real disarray. Some boroughs are amazing, some boroughs are horrendous, some are waiting 18 months to see for an appointment, and actually we have to kick in emotional and mental health for our children because they haven't been diagnosed on early enough and their self-esteem is so low, and then they start with anxieties and depression and self-harming and all the other horrendous things that go hand in hand with misdiagnosis and no diagnosis. So I don't know whether there's one right answer. I think if you're in a great borough that's got really supportive educational Senko and a great educational psychologist, then, you know, have faith in that system. But unfortunately, I don't think we can have faith in that system, and some people do have to go down the private route.
So it sounds like what you're saying is if the school is supportive and is trying to get the funding, that's probably the best way to get a thorough diagnosis. But if that's not what you might hope it would be, then that's when you start seeking help elsewhere.
One of
the things you hinted at there is really the school support and knowledge of the condition, and I just wondered, like, because I had a dyslexia expert on in episode 19 of the podcast, and talked about the fact that many schools are almost in dyslexia denial. Do you see the same thing going on with ADHD and ADD, or is it so obvious that everybody can see it and they just need to find the funding to help work with it?
I think times are changing. When my son was diagnosed back in the 80s, early 90s, it was sort of considered a bit of a, well, that's a middle class excuse for bad parenting, the same as dyslexia was a middle class excuse for bad spelling. So I think we're in a very different mindset. I think professionals now are taking it more seriously. However, I know I've interviewed a lot of young teachers, so teachers in their 20s, and when they were trained, they were given perhaps one day of special needs training.
Well, yeah, I trained as a teacher. I did a PGCE, and yes. I didn't get any special needs training at all. We were told were supposed to differentiate, but how do you differentiate if you know nothing about the special needs of the child? And that's really why I'm doing these episodes. I've done one on dyslexia. I'm doing this now. So I can educate parents and teachers about these conditions.
Yes.
And, spread the word and help people to help the children.
I mean, that just makes me absolutely sick to the stomach. I mean, so how long ago did you do that?
Your training. It was in the mid-2000s. It was kind of 2004, 2005.
We've got whole generations of children in school, these poor little babies who are sitting there. The teachers are qualified and okay to deliver the curriculum and, make science exciting and know how to deliver adverbial pronouns or whatever that nonsense is, but there'll probably be 3 out of 10 of their 3 children in their class who have got some kind of special need, and if that one child kicks off and starts throwing himself around and disrupting everybody and flicking and making low level noises, it's going to affect the learning of everybody in that class.
Yeah, and I've seen that time and time and time again in the classroom, in my own education as well as when I was a teacher.
And when it's so simple, just to put in some simple strategies within a class, I see the most brilliant teachers who get it, who understand it. And all you do is have to give that little child a little bit more of your attention.
Yeah.
And, sometimes I hear people say, well, it's not fair. Why should they get a reward? Or why should they get something extra? Why should they sit on their own? Well, if they don't, the consequence is they're going to disrupt the learning of 29 others. So what do you do?
Okay. So if parents are in the situation, and most of the parents listening to this are going to be parents of secondary school age children. So presumably their children will have had this diagnosis for some time. And I have my suspicion that probably primary school teachers are better versed in how to manage this stuff than secondary school teachers are. What should parents be doing? What should they be communicating to the school about what works in terms of managing children with this condition?
The first thing, I think they should establish a relationship with the form tutor or the SENCO, because I know once, you're very hands-on in primary and you see the teacher every day and it's all very cosy and all the parents, everybody. But when they get to secondary, you sort of feel that you lose a little bit of touch, which I guess you want to, because you want your child, your young adult now to be independent. But you need to, for their sake, establish a really good relationship.
Yeah. This is something I actually had another guest on talking about. She had a child with Asperger's syndrome and she was also a SENCO. And she talked about how important it is to develop that really strong working relationship with the tutor or the SENCO or whoever it is. Have that main point of contact in the school. And if listeners want to listen to that episode, it's number 18 of the podcast with Zoe Short. Anyway, carry on, Solly.
That's okay. So, I mean, I have a support group called Warrior Mums, and we actually met this morning. And funnily enough, we were talking. One mum was saying how her son now has been given a timeout pass, and all he has to do is hold it up, and the teacher, says, "Yeah, off you go." And he just has a little timeout. He might wander down to the toilet, or come back, or have a drink, and then that's fine as long as he does come back. Otherwise, there's consequences if he doesn't. So it's just all staff having an understanding. Maybe the child needs to sit nearer the door or have their back to the window, or have the lights turned off, because I know sometimes the lights can interfere with our children concentrating.
Will these strategies differ child by child, or are there some? Is there a core set of strategies that work for pretty much all children with these conditions?
Well, I think they will. The thing with ADHD, it's often people refer to it as ADHD plus, because unfortunately with ADHD, you almost certainly will have something else as well. Mm-hmm. So it could be that they are a little bit on the autistic spectrum. It could be that they have some kind of dyslexia. It could be that they have some sensory difficulty. Mm-hmm. It could be that they have a processing difficulty. So unfortunately, it might not just be ADHD. But I just think just the sensible thing, in fact, I haven't even said it yet, but I think the most important thing is just to ask your child, yeah. Ask the young adult, what is it that makes you feel more comfortable? How can I improve my teaching? Where can you sit that makes you concentrate more? What can I use, or what would you like to use to make notes? You know, sometimes our children find writing very difficult, so maybe they need a laptop or a tablet. Or a different size pen, or maybe they need to sit on a wobble cushion or have a weighted neck blanket. You know, but I think we just need to, particularly if we're talking about secondary school children, mm-hmm. By then, you know, they know what they can do to make them feel more able to focus and help them with their organisation. So we need to ask them what works. Do they need things colour-coded?
Yeah.
Do they need a visual timetable on the go all the time, or things in their pocket that will help them remember?
Yeah, my experience of teaching children with ADHD, I mean, the main child I remember as having this condition was the lad I talked about before. And he was literally so chaotic.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't think I would have been able to get that level of introspection out of him to be able to communicate to me what he found helpful. What do you do in that kind of circumstance?
Well, then I mean if they can, brilliant, because then they feel that they're being listened to and they're going to feel valued. But yes, you're right, if their emotional immaturity is such that they're not able to reflect on what they need, then we have to do it for them. Mm-hmm. So if you as a professional have decided, well, you can see he's chaotic, then you make him a timetable and you give him his work in very small steps, so that you finish that little section and then come to me and get the next one. You give him tons of praise and tons of rewards and little positions of responsibility, you know, just say, oh, you're amazing, just give these books out for me. You know, so we're just building them up, building their self-esteem up all the time and making them feel valued and special.
So, what you're saying there is kind of the same thing that you really ought to be doing for every child, but just kind of micromanaging it to a greater extent.
Yes.
Would you agree with me?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, you might need to break it down a little bit more for our children. They can't follow too many instructions at the same time. So you might need to just do things in much smaller steps. Mm-hmm. Then you know, you couldn't just say to him four instructions and expect them all to be done.
What are your views on inclusion of children with these conditions in mainstream classrooms? Because I mean, what you're saying, you know, I'm just remembering back to the times when I was a teacher standing at the front of the room and you've got children who are light years ahead in their kind of reading age and their written ability and their comprehension, and then you've got a child like this, and the class I'm remembering literally was like this. You've got a cluster of girls who are just amazing in their academic ability, and then you've got a little lad, there were actually two of them in this class. What do you do when you're directing the class from the front and you've got that breadth,
that
ability?
That's the challenge for all teachers, isn't it, that the breadth of ability from children who just get it immediately to those children who can barely read. You know, and I think that's the skill of a teacher, and that's when the training needs to improve. That work needs to be highly differentiated, so that, say, you're teaching geography, and you know, you're doing volcanoes, say, you have some work that is suitable for the children who can get it, and who can go on and research and do very high level thinking activities, and then you need to do a much easier activity where a child is perhaps just writing about a picture that he can see, writing about a volcano, and just describing what he sees, and it's all very simple. Maybe give him a word mat so he has the words there. There's some brilliant resources, and there's a fantastic software called Clicker, which I use with lots of my children at school. And it's basically a word processor, so it's like using Word, but it's got some incredible resources within it. So there's a predictor, there's a voice recorder, it can bring up clusters of words, it can bring up pictures. It's so you know, a teacher just has to be very creative, and find the resources and pitch it at the right level. You mentioned the word inclusion, and we have to, as much as we can, enable everything to be at the right, pitched at the right level, so we are including our children and they're not feeling excluded, because that's all part of how they feel about themselves. If everything is designed and planned so that they can really feel part of the class and how other children then will see them. Again, it's all to do with their self-esteem and building friendship and feel valued and part of that little community. So I am so passionate about inclusion. We just have to get it right.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the struggle. I think one of the questions that arises in my mind as you're talking is, when you look at the name of these conditions, like attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, that doesn't imply lower cognitive ability. So I hate saying this, but a lower IQ. I mean, just because you can't sit still and you can't concentrate for very long, it doesn't mean that you're not able to access higher order thinking skills. Is it typical that these children have, you know, impaired cognitive ability, or is it known for some of them to be, you know, at the top of the class at the same time and just maybe kind of slightly frustrated by their inability to pay attention?
That is a very, very good point. I remember my son when he was diagnosed, and we did put him on Ritalin for a little while, and he said to me, and he before then he wasn't reading, and he said, "Oh, my eyes are keeping still." So he could actually focus on the letters and the words. It's not a question of cognitive ability. It's just a question of being able to focus on what's going on. And I said before, sometimes they're focusing so much on keeping still that they're missing the content of the lesson. Or they're focusing so much on a smell they can smell, or how close they're sitting to somebody, or they're thinking of something else. Again, they're missing the content of the lesson. But that's not to say that our children aren't of very high cognitive ability, because they are. I mean, Rory Bremner did a brilliant documentary recently,
Oh, no, I don't think it was Rory Bremner. It was somebody else. I watched a Horizon programme, and I can't remember who
That was Chris Packham, were you thinking of?
No, it wasn't
Chris. Who did Asperger's.
It was Asperger's. It was some comedian, but it wasn't Rory Bremner. I can't remember if it comes back.
But Rory Bremner does have ADHD, and he talks quite openly about it. You know, and Will I Am has got ADHD, and Jim Carrey, and, you know, it's not a life sentence. It doesn't mean the end of somebody's little world. It just means school is very difficult.
So would you say, like, people talk about autism as high functioning? Do you think there are high functioning people with ADHD?
Yeah, well, yes, definitely. Well, So ADHD, yes, there are other things that children do have alongside. Yeah. And for my son, he definitely has a learning disability, but that's nothing to do with the behaviour and the ADHD. Mm-hmm. There are some children I've taught who clearly have got ADHD, but are very bright. We just have to manage their environment a little differently. Something I haven't spoken about, a lot of girls have, so without the hyperactivity, just ADD, and they present as dreamers. So they're not causing any fuss, any bother. You probably wouldn't even notice them, but they're underachieving because they're going off into their own little world and not focusing on instructions, on content. So again, they're missing a lot of learning.
Okay. Yeah. How does it change as children get older and move into their late teens and adulthood? Does the fact that they're maturing give them more kind of control over their condition?
Yeah.
Or is it that the condition actually subsides, or is it just the same throughout their lives?
Yeah, unfortunately, the condition. It's a genetic makeup. Mm-hmm. Medication can help it, but that's alongside different behaviours and the way we manage those behaviours. And yeah, I think as adults, if you know you're disorganised, you make lists. If you know you're always late, you learn to leave early. Mm-hmm. If you know you're going to lose your passport, you put it somewhere where you can find it. If you know you don't like big crowds because you interrupt, you don't go to parties. Mm-hmm. You choose the job that's going to suit you. It's not going to be a job that requires you to be thinking of a million things and multitasking. Mm-hmm. It could be a job where you give them one task and you do it, and then you move on to the next thing. So as an adult and as young adults, you would just find the thing that makes life easier for you.
Yeah.
But fortunately, children don't have that hindsight, so we have to do it for them.
Yeah. So thinking about the parents that will be listening to this podcast, and particularly getting through the exam years, have you got any tips about how they can make revision and actually sitting exams easier for their children? How they can structure that so it's more effective, if you like?
Yes, well, you just need to make it manageable, because like anything, if you've got a big mountain to climb, it will fill you with dread to start with. So chunk it up, help them with the timetable. I love colour coding, so colour code your timetable. Geography is red and maths is yellow. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got experience of secondary school, and I know you can't concentrate for more than, I think it's 20 minutes, but with our children, it's probably even less. So I would say the revision shouldn't be, for huge chunks of time, because they just won't focus.
Yeah.
If they're an audio learner, maybe put all the notes on audio on their phone.
Yeah.
Although, no, you don't want them to have their phone, because they'll be distracted. But maybe you could just get a little MP3 or something, and they could record the notes and listen to it back.
All the stuff that I always talk about is breaking it down into small chunks, focus for a short amount of time and then have a break and then come back and focus again for a short amount of time, and then really, really think about how they learn best, whether they're audio learners, whether colours, pictures, actually moving around. I had one student who was incredibly successful in her GCSEs, and she didn't make any revision notes at all, and she was using kinesthetic methods to learn all her content. And so it's, you have to break away from that idea that it's all about sitting at a desk for hours on end making reams of revision notes. It doesn't have to be like that. So.
Yeah, and then that goes back to how we teach, because how we teach is, as you say, the teacher's at the front, more or less. Children are plonked at a desk and are expected to take in. But if they're not oral learners, I know we've got the whiteboard now and we can make it interactive, and it's a little bit different, and some great teachers will make it a little bit more kinesthetic. But, that does just go back to Oh, just this, our whole system is just wrong, how we impart knowledge.
So what would you change, Solly? What would you like to see change in the system?
Well, I would like more adaptability. So if you see children who just aren't learning in that particular way, would be better doing something through drama or role play or making a poster or art or making a PowerPoint or, yeah, you know, however you can soak up knowledge, then do it like that. But we're so prescriptive with how our children should be learning and then should be working. Maybe classrooms are wrong. Maybe we need more standing desks and bouncy chairs. Or I know with our children with ADHD in primary, we have a lot of sensory cushions, and you can get those yoga bands around the bottom of a chair, and they become like a kick band.
Okay, yeah.
They're very good as well, because children who just need that to help them focus. Let children doodle while they're listening, if that's how they learn.
That's something I've heard when I've been into schools recently, when I've been talking about, you know, how do you learn best and what doesn't work for you in terms of learning. And I was talking to some sixth formers, and there was this one guy, he said, I just cannot sit and listen to a teacher talking and talking and talking. It's just useless for me. And I said, well, you need to try and make that a more active experience, you know, take notes while they're talking. They said, well, the teacher tells me to stop making notes.
And oh, that's horrendous.
Look at them and listen.
It's unbelievable. I mean, if we were talking about Victorian times, you might sort of think, you know, well, I could sort of get that. But, you know, how? I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me.
I think it's all about trust in students and trusting that students know what is best for them. Because, you know, if I had a yoga band around my chair and I was kicking it, that would be a distraction to me. And so it's hard for me to empathise with a child that's I can't quite get my head around how that might help, but you know, you have to suspend that disbelief and actually trust that.
And it does. You're totally right. But it does. You know, the proof of the pudding. You know, I've seen amazing results. Just those little wooden blocks, those fiddle toys. They cost £1.20, and I've given those to boys who just suddenly can now focus on what the teacher's saying.
Because what about fidget spinners? What do you think about that?
Oh, well, that was such a shame, because the premise of it is, so like these little wooden blocks that you do, it does help children focus, because you have to suspend disbelief, because if it's nothing that is in your understanding, we can't put ourselves in that position. But it's all to do with sensory equilibrium, and you're either under or over a particular need for a sense, and by fiddling it enables you to reach back to that equilibrium where you can then focus and clearly understand what people are saying. And some people have a hypo and some people are hyper, so it depends where you are on that spectrum, what you need to do. So some children just have to fiddle to get back their focus, and they can. But with those fiddle spinners, because it became such a fad, and it then became like a toy, then they did get banned from schools.
I think too many children that didn't actually need them were trying to use them, and that was the problem there.
Exactly. I say to my children at work that I give them to, if you're distracting other people or if you're being distracted by it, I'll take it away. You're only using it if it helps you. And then we make a judgment whether it's helping. And I'd say 7 times out of 10 it is.
That leads me on to another question. It's something that keeps coming up in my Facebook group, which is full of parents. And that's the question of boundaries.
Yes.
And like as a parent and as a teacher, I really learned this in the classroom before I had children of my own, the importance of boundaries and, you know, laying out what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And it's really important as a parent as well. How does that play into having a child with ADHD or ADD? Is it even more important to have those really clear boundaries, or do you have to be a little bit more flexible about them because your child perhaps doesn't quite get it in the same way that other children do?
I think boundaries are vital. I think children like to know that they are, that there is somebody else keeping an eye out for them. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be out of control. They don't want to have freedom to do absolutely everything that they want. They have to have that sense of security that there are boundaries. Mm-hmm. I think it's vital that children know just how far that they can go, and that there will be some consequences if there is extreme bad behaviour.
And do the boundaries help children with this, you know, you explained at the beginning how ADHD, they basically don't have that self-control over their behaviour. Does knowing where the boundaries lie help them with that self-control?
I don't think it's up to our children to, now let me backtrack. I think it's up to us to create an environment and to help our children so that they feel safe and secure and listened to, and that their little world is okay. Mm-hmm. So if we know, for instance, that our children are going to be really hyperactive and it's a birthday party and it's a family occasion and we've got to go, then I think it's up to us to first of all make sure, so I'm talking about primary mainly, but I guess this could be secondary, it's up to us to make sure they've had enough to eat, so they're not gonna start getting hungry. Miserable. They're not too hot, they're not too cold, there's that you take along your emergency pack, so that there's a book, an emergency food, things for them to do, maybe a little Lego model. And then when things are, and you can see that they've had enough, you leave.
Yeah.
So if you're creating an environment and you're preparing and you're planning and everything is okay for them, you know, they're not feeling too hot, they're not hungry, they're entertained, and you quit whilst you're ahead, it should be okay. If you don't plan like that and they end up hitting their cousin and everybody else is sitting at the table except them, and they're bored and they're banging the table with their knife and fork and they're flicking and they're trying to get everybody's attention, well, you haven't planned their world. So I wouldn't want to think that that child is now being punished because they're behaving like that. Saying that, yes, they you know, if they hit their cousin, then you have to say, you know, that's inappropriate and look how you've made them sad and all that.
It's about creating that environment. You know, I've done that with my own children. You know, you have the snacks, you have the toys, you have the book to entertain them in the restaurant. And you know, I've been into many restaurants where everybody around us has laughed when we get out the back of the thing of Duplo and put it on the restaurant table so the children have got something to do.
Yeah,
but you know, they can get to the point, even when you've put all those things in place, where maybe something gets out of control. And yeah, they do need to know that's unacceptable, but you also have to take some of that responsibility as a parent, don't you?
Yes. Yeah. I because underneath all the ADHD, there is normal children behaviour. And, you know, when they get to teenage, you know, there's going to be normal tantrums and emotional and hormonal things going on as well. So, you know, they'll go out late and then you still have to say to them, you need to be back by 11. And if they're not back by 11, there's a curfew or there's a punishment or a consequence.
Yeah.
I would say with all these consequences to discuss it beforehand. So you say, if you're not back by 11, then next time you go out, you have to be back by 9, or I'm taking away your iPad for an hour, or, you know, so let them know.
They know what the consequences are going to be in advance. Before.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we're getting quite near the end now, Solly. I think what we've
it's gone so quickly.
It really has, hasn't it? What I would love to hear before we end up is your story a little bit. Because you've said that your son has ADHD, and I'd love to know how that has influenced your career and your expertise in this area.
Oh, massively. So my story, so we actually adopted our son. Mm-hmm. So he came to us at 14 months. And at that point, I was just a teacher tootling along with my career. and it sort of changed my life, really, because he did turn my world upside down in lots of different ways.
Did you know that there might be problems before you adopted
yes.
him?
Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So from that point, I sort of, and then as a teacher, I sort of always got the naughty boys. Well, I mean, I say naughty, I shouldn't really, but you know, I got the cheeky boys. You know, I understood why they were behaving like that, and I really liked them, and understood that, do you know what, if you smile at them and give them a few little jobs and make the work adaptable that they're going to achieve, then everything's going to be okay. So I then specialised at work with special needs. Mm-hmm. And now at my school, I'm the assistant Senko. So that's that side of my life. My son, as I say, is now 29. His life is still very hard because he can't stick with a job. He hasn't really found the thing he does yet that he can stick at. Mm-hmm. He gets bored very easily and he can't follow instructions, so he'll stay somewhere for a few months and then just move on, which is difficult.
Does he live at home with you, or does he live
he does home? Only because I can't see how, you know, financially, well, this is the other thing, financially he's found that you can get credit cards.
Oof.
Which, you know, however much we say to him this is a bad choice, he's so impulsive that he does it, and he'll continue to do it. So that's really tricky at the moment. But last year I set up my own consultancy, Yellow Sun, because I could just see that when I'm at work and I'm supporting families at school, I can just see, you know, we're quite good at school understanding, and quite good at adapting lessons and supporting children. But I could see these mothers who would attend my meetings and annual reviews, and you know, they'd just be in tears because they just don't know how to handle the children at home. So
and they don't know how to fight for what they need at school as
exactly
well.
And they don't know what, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So I set up my consultancy really just to support families and just help parents, you know, understand just with a few simple tweaks things can be massively different at home. Mm-hmm. And with great relationship with the school, we can work together to make things better at school as well. So that's going well.
That sounds fantastic. Well, could you tell parents where they can find out more about you, if, you know, they've really resonated with what you've had to say today?
Well, that is really great. So I have a Facebook page, Yellow Sun. Mm-hmm. I have a Twitter, which is also Solly_YellowSun. I have an Instagram, which is Solly_YellowSun. And I have a blog, which is Solly, do we say hyphen or dash?
Dash. Either.
Dash. It's solly-lazarus.com. And as we speak, which is very, very exciting, I am launching a free training series called Live a Happy Life with ADHD.
Oh, that sounds great.
And that is going very well as well. There's some training videos. The first one is how to stop the rudeness in the back chat. The second one is how to build self-esteem. And the third one is blowing wide open the myths surrounding ADHD.
Fantastic. So how do parents find that and access that, Solly?
So that is if they go to www.liveahappylifewithadhd.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'll put a link to that in the in the show notes so that people can just click on that and find that.
Oh, thank you so much. That would be great. I think sort of a bit like you, Lucy, I just want to spread the word that there is another way. Unfortunately, so many of our children end up in a very negative place emotionally. Many end up, unfortunately, in prison. You know, so we need to spread the word that this is not a life sentence. Just with changing things up a little bit, we can make our children feel amazing about themselves. Yes, school won't suit them, probably, but once we can get through that as an adult, they can make some really great choices and live a happy life. They can be in great relationships. And choose great jobs that will suit them.
Well, that's such a positive and fantastic message to end this episode on. So thank you so much, Solly, for sharing your experience and wisdom with me and all my listeners today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Lucy. And thank you for asking me. And you too, keep up the good work. We need to get it out there that don't give up on our special children.
No. Thank you, Solly. Goodbye.
Bye.
I thought that was an absolutely fantastic conversation with Solly. She is so passionate. And the thing that I found so interesting talking to people like Solly and Zoe Short is that the people who've kind of made it into their vocation to work with children with special educational needs are also the people who have direct personal experience of children who are learning to live with these issues. So I think that's just a really interesting observation and something that I just wanted to highlight to you. So you've heard all about where to find out where to speak to Solly, so please reach out to her if you feel that you would like to. If you'd like to give me some feedback about this episode, I'd love to hear from you in the Facebook group, my Facebook group, which is exclusively for parents of secondary school students. And you can find that on Facebook. It's called the Supportive Parents Successful Students Community, or you can find the link to that in the show notes and just request to join. Or reach out to me on Twitter at Lucy C. Parsons, or indeed send me an email, and my email address is lucy@lifemoreextraordinary.com. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you spending your time with me and Solly today. Have a wonderful day and goodbye.